Thank you very much, David, for the nice introduction. And yeah, it's a pleasure for me to introduce the program on fluctuation forces to you. As David said, we have participants from a variety of backgrounds: statistical mechanics, condensed matter, biophysics, some high energy physics. And of course, in my talk, I cannot cover all the interesting things which are going on in the program, but I would like to start first with kind of a historical introduction on fluctuation forces in general, and then become more specific and look at problems which we are currently studying within this exciting program. So let me begin by giving you an outline. So first, what are fluctuation forces and what are their main properties? Then I will show you some new experimental results. So these experiments will actually lead us to some interesting questions which we try to answer during this program. And so I would like to talk about the challenges for theory which come in part from the new experiments that are going on. And finally, if time allows, I will go into more detail into a specific question which is related to how these forces are modified by the material properties of the objects that interact and by their shape. So I'm going to look at geometry or different shapes and the material side or aspect of fluctuation force. Okay, so let me begin with the first part. So the effect of fluctuation forces were actually postulated quite a long time ago by van der Waals to account or to describe basically ideal gases. And so what he said is that was 1873, that there must be an attractive force between neutral, and that's important, molecules in a gas. And so this was at that time more a postulation, and it was not so clear where these forces actually come from or how to compute them and calculate them. And so there's some confusion nowadays about what name should be given to these forces. We know the Casimir effect, then there are the van der Waals forces, the London interaction. And so currently it appears, at least to me, that van der Waals forces is basically a name which describes all this kind of fluctuation forces and phenomena, which then later have been named differently. And so what is the...
But van der Waals attributes these, the attraction to electricity and magnetism?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the idea, yeah. But there are various, I'm going to into more detail, I'm going to explain what kind of sources for these attractive forces are there.
And the selection, by the way, was basically fitting the experimental
right
data.
Right.
And the origin of these conclusion, very important conclusion, was that there was, as you said, this long-range attraction, but he did not concern himself with the origin.
Yeah. Right, so, and nowadays we know that this long-range attraction is due to fluctuations. So how can this come about? If you take two molecules, neutral molecules, you have just already at zero, I mean, even at zero temperature, all these charge fluctuations from the electrons. And so you create, at some instance, a transient dipole in one of the molecules, which induces another dipole in the second molecule, and these two dipoles interact. And so this is a, well, these dipoles, they are not permanent, they are fluctuating dipoles, and therefore you can expect that this is a very weak force, and it's coming from, at zero temperature, quantum fluctuations, so it's expected to proportional to h bar, the and the velocity of light, or some material properties. There are various limiting cases I'm not going to describe. Well, before I go and come to quantum mechanics, there are actually earlier versions of these forces. Keesom predicted a potential or energy which goes like 1 over distance to the fixed power, where distance d is the distance between the actually dipoles. And this conclusion he found for two permanent dipoles. But of course, permanent dipoles, they interact with 1 over distance cubed, so they have, he assumed that they have random orientation due to thermal fluctuations. So they are random dipoles. And so if the temperature is much bigger than the interaction energy between these dipoles, you expect this effect to disappear. And therefore, this is inverse proportional to temperature at the limit of high temperatures. So it's actually an effect which is destroyed by fluctuation and not generated by fluctuation. But this is one of the first fluctuation forces. And they are these kind of forces summarized also under the name of van der Waals. Then Debye found the same power law in 1920 by considering a permanent dipole interacting with a neutral molecule. So that's a permanent dipole and a neutral molecule. Same power law, but different temperature dependence. So this is basically explained by classical physics. Now, at low temperatures or small distances, there's another source of these fluctuation forces. And the first one to look at this was London. That was 1930. And so what he considered is, let's take two neutral molecules, say at a distance d, and look at the interaction energy as a function of separation at zero temperature. And he considered explicitly the quantum fluctuation of the charges, so you have a local transient dipoles which interact. And what he got is an interaction which is proportional to h bar, a characteristic frequency, the characteristic frequency of the transition, lowest transition in this molecules or atoms, and again the fixed power of separation, and this is proportional to the static dipole polarizability of the atoms. So this was the first kind of microscopic theory which explained the original proposal by van der Waals. Now, this interaction was actually found to be inconsistent with some experiments, which showed a slightly more stronger decrease of the potential at larger separations. And that motivated actually Casimir and Polder to look at the effect of retardation on this interaction. So you expect retardation to become important when the distance d becomes larger than some characteristic length scale, which is set by the frequency. And, of course, the velocity of light. So c divided by omega 0 sets a length scale, and that's a typical scale. That omega 0 is the scale, time scale, the signal needs to travel from this to the other atom. And so beyond this length scale, what actually Casimir and Polder found is quite interesting. First, they could explain, well, there's a minus, it's an attractive force, that it decays faster with separation by one power. But then they found that the amplitude actually becomes independent of this frequency. It becomes universal, and it's given by h bar times c. But still, it's proportional to the product of the two polarizabilities. So that's the picture at zero temperature. Retardation is important for this fluctuation-induced interactions. And now we know how this, at least at zero temperature, how these single molecules and atoms interact. But what does it imply for condensed matter, or say solids, liquids, if you want to go to beyond gases? And so we have to know the interaction.
Clarification.
Sure.
So since you have an alpha 1 and alpha 2, you are discussing the case of two, in general, different molecules.
Yes.
What then is the omega naught?
Well, here I assume that they have the same omega naught. It just comes from a simple, say, two-level model. And so if you have really that's just the energy difference between the ground state and the first excited state.
So in general, if we have two different molecules, they'll be different.
Right, they will be different, and then things become much more complicated because you have to take into account higher excited states, and there can be anisotropies. Then I'm just giving here the simplest picture. So but
okay. My second question is sort of related. The alphas, as I understand their definitions, are themselves frequency dependent.
Well, yes, yeah.
So the epsilon there is in fact frequency dependent, strongly frequency dependent, through the alphas.
Yes, right? Yeah. But at this 1 over d to the 7th power, what contributes is the zero frequency limit of the polarizabilities. And only if you go to shorter separations, you need frequency dependence. What I've written here is actually the static, the zero frequency limit of the polarizability. Okay. Now, let's look at the situation where you have continuous media composed of many of these fluctuating dipoles. And let's look at the simple situation where you have two infinite media separated by a gap d. And you're asking for the fluctuation-induced interaction between these two surfaces. Now, there was a first approach to this which is due to Hamaker. And so what he has said is, let's take the interaction between all pairs of atoms or molecules. Well, this is something which you, of course, can question, because fluctuation forces are non-additive, and that's an important property. Because if you have two dipoles fluctuating and bring close a third dipole, that of course changes the interaction between the first two dipoles, so it's highly non-local effect, and so this pairwise additivity is not expected to work at all. But despite that, what Hamacher found by this assumption is that you have a rather slow decay of the energy. Between two surfaces, so it's proportional to the area of the surfaces, the energy, and then it decays like d squared. And that's just because you integrate over the volume. So this effect is somehow amplified by the fact that you have these macroscopic surfaces, but there is some amplitude here, C, which is computed by this pairwise additivity assumption, but this is not reliable. But it turned out that actually the power law 1 over d squared is correct for this particular geometry. We will see later on more complicated. This is what I call PVS, pairwise summation approximation. So how can you do better if you have macroscopic objects and want to compute the amplitude and check if the power law is actually correct?
This is for the case where those two are not far enough separated for retardation to be important. Is there a crossover?
Well, that's true. This is actually the non-retarded limit, yeah. That's the energy, it goes like d squared. Right. That was the limit Hamacher was looking at, right. Okay, so somewhat later, and motivated by his work together with Polder, actually Casimir looked exactly this case in a simplified version. He looked at two metallic objects and he assumed that they are perfect metal surfaces. That was in 48. And also he took a completely different perspective. He didn't consider the charge fluctuations inside the objects, but he considered the fluctuations of the electromagnetic field in between them. And so since he assumed that you have perfect metal boundaries, he just imposed boundary conditions, standard boundary conditions of the electromagnetic field on these two boundaries, and computed the ground state energy of all the electromagnetic modes, that is quantum mechanical harmonical oscillators in between. So what you write down for the energy is a sum over all modes. Let's number them by n. And h bar over 2 omega n. Okay? Omega n are the frequencies of all allowed modes between. Of course, this is an infinite quantity. And what you would measure if you move these surfaces is a change in energy with the distance d. And that you get, so you take this at distance d and subtract from it the same quantity for d to infinity. And that you can do, so you get a change in the energy, and that turns out to be finite. And this gives this famous result for the energy. Universal amplitude, pi squared over 720. It's proportional to h bar c, area divided by d cubed. So this is the first case where this amplitude has been actually calculated exactly. And as you pointed out, the difference in the power law comes from the fact that this perfect metal limit is always in the retarded limit, of course. And this is the non-retarded limit. Okay. And finally, came Lifshitz, and that was in 1954, to generalize this result to arbitrary dielectric continuous media. So you put here a material with epsilon of omega. You can put actually some, say, liquid in between the metal described by a different dielectric function. And here you have another material. And he again looked at the field fluctuations, imposed the boundary conditions between the dielectrics, which we know from classical electrodynamics, and computed the interaction energy. And if you do this, you get an expression for the energy, which is somewhat complicated, but I just write down the general structure of it. So you get basically integrals over the k vectors parallel to the surface. You get an integral over all frequencies. And then you get the logarithm of 1 minus. And now you get some functions t1 sitting here and t2 sitting here, which depend on the dielectric functions. So they are epsilon dependent. You get that for the second object. And this is multiplied by some exponential with a frequency dependent coefficient times the distance d. So all the material dependence goes into these functions, and then the distance dependence is just here in the exponential. And all these functions are frequency and momentum dependent, and then given if you know the dielectric response of the material, you can plug it in here and get the interaction energy. So that's what is known as Lifshitz theory. And actually, Lifshitz theory is the basis of most studies of these fluctuation forces because it can be applied basically to all kinds of materials, but it has a strong limitation, and that's it just applies to situations where you have two perfectly flat parallel surfaces. So it does not take into account geometrical effects. Now, so far I talked mainly about zero temperature effects. What happens if you have finite temperature? So this has two effects. Finite temperature first gives a correction to these electromagnetical forces because now you have thermally excited photons. But there are also other fluctuation forces which just come from finite temperature. And so this was actually pointed out by Fischer and Degen. In the 70s. And so they considered the thermal fluctuations which you have close to a critical point. So the fluctuations are gapless, and therefore you can expect that they also give rise to long-ranged fluctuation forces. And they computed these forces which for this geometry gives you an energy which is now proportional to kBT, because now you have thermal fluctuations. It can be attractive or repulsive. Both cases are possible. And then it decays with d squared. It's proportional to area. So this is due to critical fluctuations. And this has been actually applied, so this is close to a critical point, and then there are other soft matter systems which display or show this kind of fluctuation forces, for example, liquid crystals. Polymer systems, as pointed out by K. Kai last week. And another example of these thermal forces are inclusions on biomembranes. So if a membrane, and you put some kind of proteins on top of this membrane which suppress locally the fluctuations of the membrane, that creates also effective interaction between these inclusions. Okay, now if you're interested in finite temperature effects, we should actually go back to the simplest case here and look what happens if we have finite temperatures here. So now if we have temperature, we have a second energy scale. And if we compare the thermal energy to the energy sitting here, we get a length scale. And that's the de Broglie wavelength of the photons, right? And that introduces actually a second length scale here. Let's call it lambda t. And it's h bar c over kBt. Now, if you had finite temperature and go to large separations, you finally cross this length scale, and then you get a classical behavior for the energy, which is proportional to kBt. And now, interestingly, decays again like d to the sixth. So it's changing back to the non-retarded limit. And it's again proportional to the polarizabilities alpha 1 and alpha 2. So that's the classical limit of this interaction. Okay, now let me come to the second point, because you might ask now, if we understand all these fluctuation forces, we know what happens at finite temperatures, how they depend on material, because we have Lifshitz theory. So why should we have this program and look at these forces again? Well, during the last 10 years, there was substantial progress on the experimental side. And people have started to measure this QED fluctuation forces between metals very accurately. And they are actually experimental results which are not explained so far by theory. And I would like to give you some examples of these experiments now. So let me erase this. So first, we have experiment on QED fluctuation and metallic objects. So this, the first high-precision experiment was carried out by Lamoureux in 97, about 10 years ago. And what he considered was actually a geometry. We'll take a metallic plate and put a large sphere close to it, and then he measured the force. So why do you take a sphere? If you would take two plates, it would be very difficult to keep the distance between the plates constant about across the area. So therefore, this is, for experimental reasons, much better to do this. And he could confirm, for the first time with high precision, the original prediction by Casimir. And since then, they have a series of experiments which increased accuracy. Now people have even measured the force between parallel plates directly, of course with a larger error. And crossed cylinders have been considered, so various geometries.
What about, what's the status of now quite old Russian experiments?
Right. I mean, yeah. These experiments, they also saw some effect of attraction, of course, but they were not conclusive about the amplitude, and I think even the power law was somehow not clear that it is 1 over d to the force for the force, with Casimir force.
And
I saw that there were some actually issues that sometimes even it was not clear if it's repulsive or attractive in the very early experiments.
There were huge arguments between the Dutch people and the Russian people.
Okay.
Charge effects.
Yeah.
Straight charge effects, but I think the Russians cleaned it up enough
so
that they got very good results.
Okay.
And particularly with glasses.
Yeah, they looked at not at metals, right?
Optical properties well enough to make a really good prediction. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Now, having measured the forces between, say, these planar objects, or almost planar objects, usually this, the radius of curvature here is much bigger than the separation, people started to look at what happens if you take, for example, structured surfaces. And so if you have a surface with a structure, say a periodic modulation of the surface profile, then there comes up the question about the effect, say, of curvature or edges on these fluctuation forces. I would like to show you a recent experimental result from this year, actually. So here the force was experimental results by Hobon Chan. He's actually coming also to visit KITP during the next weeks. And this is an experiment he did last year. So he measured the force not between a flat plate, but between a plate which has this kind of very strong corrugation on a nanometer scale and a sphere, which he brought close to the surface. And so here's what is shown here is the interaction normalized to what you would expect from simple pairwise additivity approximations. Well, it's not that simple. They took already into account some normalization of this pairwise additivity to correct for this coefficient C you don't know exactly, so that it matches the exact value if you have no structure on the surface. And if you do the, if that would be correct, the experimental data should sit on this line here. But what they actually found is this. This is for two different wavelengths of the corrugation. And so this solid line here and the dashed line, they correspond to experimental, to theoretical predictions for perfect metals. So they had, of course, no perfect metals. They took silicon and gold. And so there's some deviation, but the tendency looks right. Okay, so this is some direction experiments go. Then people start to look at the effect of anisotropy. So you take anisotropic materials or shapes. And then what can be expected is actually a Casimir torque on the objects. And we will hear about this during our program, especially from Federico Carpasso, who will come and talk about these effects. They're trying to measure this experimentally. Then another system where the effect of curvature is very important is the interaction between nanotubes. They are very thin, like a nanometer in diameter, and so if they come close together, they have a strong fluctuation-induced interaction, and the radius of curvature is here very small, so we don't expect that the interaction between nanotubes is at all described by this picture. Then there are nice experiments in atomic physics.
Excuse me, can I ask a question before you go on to something?
Yeah.
If I heard you correctly, the experiments that you showed,
yes,
I think they were the last ones that you showed, were between silicon, a gold surface.
Silicon was a modulated surface, and gold was a sphere. Yes.
Okay. Now, of course, silicon is not a metal.
Yes.
So how was the comparison made then? Was it made?
Well, you mean between theory and experimental?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the comparison, of course, cannot be directly made because the theory was for perfect metals, but it was just, I mean, what I showed you was the result for perfect metals and the experimental findings for the real materials. So, of course, there's a difference in amplitude, but the dependence on the wavelengths of the corrugation, that is the dependence on the geometrical properties of the surface, looked right. But so, of course, I mean, the theory for realistic materials is still missing. Yeah.
Well, I would particularly worry here, modeling a small gap insulator by metal.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, all these effects coupling together, say, material and geometrical effects are not explored yet completely. Probably, yes. Probably. Okay. So let me move on to atomic physics. And so there, interesting experiments which look at the following problems. So let's take a surface, say gold, and then you scatter helium atoms from the surface. And these experiments, based on spin echo methods, have been performed in Heidelberg, and they're able to measure very accurately the equivalent of these two cases for a wall and an atom. So that was actually a case studied by Kazin, Mir, and Polder in the same paper. And so they could confirm these predictions to very high precision, and now they moved on and looked at a different situation, and they put kind of a periodic structure on the surface. And they do it in a way that it's actually uniaxial corrugated. And they again look at the reflection, quantum reflection of atoms from that surface. And what they find is so what they try to do is to fit their experimental results to this kind of power loss, of course with a reduced exponent here because it's not between two atoms but between a mirror and an atom. And what they found is that the exponent for the decay or for the distance dependence depends on the direction the atoms fly across this modulated surface. And they think that this is a geometric effect. So it's different if you go this way, or if you go this way, or I think it even changes if you cross it this way. Well, you can question if it's okay to fit it to this power law, but they don't know how this effect can be explained theoretically. And this shows that geometry has a strong effect on this interaction. And actually, what they can measure, they have such a high precision that they can measure actually a quite interesting dynamic effect. So let's assume you have this dipole, fluctuating dipole, flying with a certain velocity as it does here across the surface. Now this creates a mirror image here in the material, which also moves with a finite velocity, but it has to move through the material, so there's some dissipation of energy, and therefore you get actually a friction force on this atom, which is extremely small, but it's in the range of nanoelectron volt in the experiment, and that they can resolve. They claim that they have measured this. And that brings me actually to this interesting problem that is what is called the dynamical Casimir effect. The question is, what happens if you have actually an atom or a surface which moves with a finite velocity or is accelerated close to another surface, how this modifies the interaction? And this is, very little is known on the theory side about this. And they think that they can probe actually some of these questions experimentally. Yes. Nice experiment. Then there are also new exciting experiment on thermal Casimir forces. And one class of experiments is actually, we heard last week about it, where you study the wetting film of helium on a metal surface. So you can measure very accurately the wetting layer of liquid helium on a metallic surface. And so you have this wetting effect due to basically Lifshitz theory. Well, Lifshitz theory does not only predict attractive forces, but also repulsive forces. And that's the case if this epsilon 2 is actually in between epsilon 1 and epsilon 3. And that's the case if you have a metal here, helium here, liquid and vacuum here, or air. So you have an repulsive force then, and that means that this layer wants to expand, and that's actually the force which drives the wetting. And now what Chen actually did in his experiment was he cooled helium down so to cross the go to a superfluid phase, and close to the phase transition he found that the film becomes actually thinner, and this is due to an increased due to increased fluctuations at the critical point, and that's actually coming from this effect proposed by Degen and Fischer. And then this is a quite general phenomenon to have this fluctuation-induced effects close to a critical point. And very recent experiment confirmed this in a very nice way also for binary fluid. Where it's not the fluctuations of the superfluid order parameter, but now it's these are fluctuations in the basically density fluctuations in this binary fluid mixture. And from this experiment, they could even determine quite nicely what happens if you go away from the critical point. So then the fluctuations acquire a small mass, and they could actually measure the scaling function and compare this with theory, and found incredibly good agreement. Okay, now this is a short and incomplete overview about the experimental stuff. And now let me go on to challenges. And I think from these experiments, we have seen that actually material properties and the effect of geometry is quite important. And so one definitely has to go beyond this simple situation. So what are the challenges? Well, as I said, many experiments actually use this kind of geometry. You have a sphere, a large sphere, close to a surface. That was also used for the critical Casimir forces, for example, to measure this force in the binary liquid mixture. And what people usually do, if the radius is very large, you say, well, I can compose this into many surface elements that are parallel to that surface. And so I just take the sum of the forces between the surface elements, and that's called proximity approximation. And that works quite well at very short separations. But it has a disadvantage in the sense that it's kind of zeroth order approximation, and it's uncontrolled because you have basically no way to check what the next order correction is. And so this is somewhat limited if you want to go to larger separations or stronger curvature. And so this works for small curvature, then it's okay. And the other approach I mentioned before is if you have some object here and you have fluctuating dipoles here and there, you just do this kind of pairwise summation. We've seen that this is not good for metals, but that's okay if you have a dilute system, so if the dielectric function is not very different from one. Okay? But if you have a metal and it has strong curvature, that's certainly the worst case you can think of. And so the questions we are trying to answer during this program are to see what is the effect of material on the interaction and, say, temperature. Because the geometry, if you have strong curvature, changes the density of states, which is available to the photons, which can be excited thermally, and therefore you expect also a strong dependence of the thermal correction to the zero temperature Casimir effect from geometry on shape. Well, then I mentioned before dynamic Casimir effect. Casimir effects related to moving boundaries or objects or atoms. Then there's the question about under what situations the force is actually attractive or when it is repulsive. There is no conclusive answer to this. It's even not, also it's believed that if you take two metallic objects, like compact objects, they will always attract, but there's no theorem which proves that. So that's still open. But we know, of course, that there are repulsive forces, for example, in these helium systems. Then interacting systems, that's certainly much more complicated. So nice things about photons is that they don't interact with themselves. But if you go close to a critical point, you have an interacting field theory, and then you want to know how, say, geometry modifies this interaction, that's certainly interacting system and geometry, certainly a very hard problem, which is, however, relevant to this critical systems or colloidal or polymer systems. Okay, so how much time do I have? Like 15, 20 minutes? Oh, 10 minutes. Okay. Okay, now let me actually go to the last point and look at some new results and effects which result from geometry, shape, and material properties, the objects. And to give you a simple example, let's look at the following situation. So we take a surface and put next to it a one-dimensional structure, just to see the dependence on dimensions. So we put, let's say, a cylinder here, okay, and ask for the interaction. So what would you guess how the interaction goes with separation? Well, okay, so let's see what could happen. Is first, you could say it's like in this situation here, and it's proportional to area. So if it's proportional to area, it should be, let's say this is length L, radius R. So it should be proportional to L times R. That's the area of this cylinder seen from the plate. You have h bar c here, which is a length scale, so you have to divide by d cubed. Okay? Or you could say it's like in these situations here, for the compact objects like atoms, where it scales like the volume of the two objects, right? Or that you would also get from a kind of pairwise summation. So that would give you something like h bar c l r squared over d to the fourth. Okay? Well, then you could also apply this technique I've explained here, proximity force approximation, which is limited to short separations, of course. And if you do the calculation, so let's call this proximity force approximation, that gives you something which looks even more complicated. Get the square root of the radius divided by d minus r to the fifth. So let's look somewhat complicated, but it's limited to short separations, actually this divergence. Now we did the calculation for this situation and could get actually for large d, so let's look at the limit where d is much bigger than r, the exact answer. And so the exact result is that, of course, you have an h bar c here. But what we found, okay, so yes, that's right. What we get is, of course, it's proportional to the length. It must be extensive. But then it has a very slow decay, the separation, which is just b squared. So where's the radius? There's no radius over here, and that's the reason it can decay like d 1 over d squared. The radius just goes into a log, right? Distance over radius, actually squared. So that's the exact answer. Sorry, no, there's no square. That's the exact answer for this situation. Now, let's see what happens if you, or maybe I should, I can show you some. Actually, this is the whole picture you get. So you have this, this is a cut, the wall and the cylinder. And so this is the energy normalized to what you would expect from proximity force approximation, short separations, it goes to 1. But then you see that actually there are two different contributions. One is from transversal magnetic modes, and the other one is from transversal electric modes. And by looking at this different behavior, you can actually understand what's going on physically and why you have this interaction. So this dependence on separation just comes from this part here. From the transverse magnetic modes. And in large separations, you can completely ignore this. So the electromagnetic part is just the sum of the two. And it's dominated at large separations just by the TM waves. Well, the GM waves, as the name says, is a wave where you have an electric field, only electric field along the axis, and the TE waves, they don't have electric field along this axis. And you can actually trace back this interaction to arbitrary long-scale charge fluctuations along the cylinder axis. And they're only allowed if you allow for electric field along the axis. And that's the reason. So from this picture, it's also clear that there must be a big difference between, say, interaction between metals or dielectrics. In metals, you can have this delocalized large-scale charge fluctuations. However, if you're dielectric, you have kind of localized dipole fluctuations, and then you don't expect this logarithmic and this slow decay.
That's normalized to PFA?
Yeah, that's normalized to this thing here. Yeah. No, okay, no, that's just because of the normalization. It's always attractive, yeah. But it's getting worse if you go to larger separation, because then it's basically the different power law that destroys this approximation completely. Okay, so there are actually other surprising effects. For example, well, let's look at the situation. There are various things which come out with surprising results. So actually, let me add a second cylinder to this geometry, okay? Now you can ask, what is the interaction between two cylinders? That actually turns out to be the same thing here if you put a square here, okay? So that's the interaction between two cylinders. Now D is the separation between the cylinders. Now if you move them close to a surface, what happens? If it would be pairwise additive, there should be no effect of the third object on the two cylinders, but we know it isn't. So what is the effect? And that's actually a calculation we have done recently. Let me just show you the answer. So you can put one or two plates. Let us look at this case. So again, we have the magnetic and electric modes. And H is the separation of the two guys from the plane surface. So if H is very large, we have just the picture we had before. Now you bring in the plate and you move down here. And so then actually the TM and TE modes go the opposite. So the one goes down and the other one goes up. And so you have a competition between the two, and that competition leads actually to a minimum in the force, not the energy, in the force. So the force is always attractive, but it's non-monotonic. And then it's going up again. And this effect is even more pronounced if you sandwich the two cylinders between the two plates. So that's just an effect of non-additivity. Okay. So, okay, maybe another, since I said that, and that was a question coming up a couple of times during our program. So what is the effect of temperature and geometry? Now, let's look again at the situation where you have just one cylinder and ask for the change of the interaction with temperature. So we've seen here that simple temperature dependence for a two-body interaction, and we know from two perfectly conducting plates that the temperature corrections are actually exponentially small. Now what happens here is actually easily understood if you look at the density of states for this system. Right, and I've just, because I can't draw it so nicely, shown it to you here. So these are again the electric and magnetic modes. And so this is a frequency normalized to the distance, and that's a change in the density of state. That's a relevant quantity which tells you where the thermally excited photons can go in that system. Of course, clearly you have a peak there where the frequency is proportional to the inverse separation between the objects, but then the important thing is that the density of states has this heavy weight here at low frequencies for the magnetic modes. This is a normal scale, and here on this log scale you see it's for the magnetic modes exponentially suppressed at small frequency. So that means if you go to finite temperature, the thermal photons want to go here, and actually that gives you a logarithmic temperature dependence. And so the correction to the energy, that's actually then the free energy, due to thermal fluctuations, well, it has this kBT here, and it's proportional to the length of the cylinder, but then it just goes like 1 over d, and you get a log of the thermal crossover length scale here, which is inverse proportional to temperature and the radius. So you have a very unusual temperature dependence, and actually these temperature effects are very long range. They decay only like 1 over d. So that's certainly something which one has to keep in mind when looking at these carbon nanotubes. Okay, well, there have been other we have 5 more minutes? Okay. Okay, so then let me just... Okay, I skip this. And explain basically very briefly how we get all these results. And, well, I just say it in words and then show you some, in the last 2 minutes, some new results. So the idea is the following. So now we go actually to compute these interactions for various geometries and materials. What we do is we go back to the original picture where we have fluctuating charges. And what you can do is you can write down an effective action for the multipoles which come from this fluctuating charges. So you have fluctuating multipoles on these objects. And so in this effective action go basically 2 different pieces. One is the universal function which tells you how these multipoles interact that you get from classical electrodynamics. And then there's a second piece which tells you how easy it is to induce multipoles on a given shape. And that, of course, depends on the shape and various things. We know polarizability tensors depend on the shape and material of a given object. And if you go to finite frequencies and look at these objects and see how easy it is to induce multiple moments in this object by an electromagnetic wave hitting this object at a finite frequency, that's actually described by the scattering matrix of this object. And therefore, this effective action contains the scattering matrices of the individual objects. And if you integrate out now all the charge fluctuations inside the object, you get an answer for the Casimir energy, which depends just on the scattering data of each individual object. You no longer have to solve the complicated problem of all the objects there at the same time, but just for each object separately. And that gives you the scattering matrices for the objects, and they are combined with these universal matrices which actually describe how they are oriented and positioned relative to each other. And so basically that's this new approach we use to look at these various cases. And to conclude, I would like to show you actually results for compact shapes. So for example, it was only last year that the problem of 2 conducting spheres, the interaction between 2 conducting spheres, could be solved. We just knew it for large separations, what atoms do, but if we take a condenses atoms to a sphere and have actually a spheres where the radius is comparable to the separation, then you need all these higher order multipoles, and the interaction can be computed. But here I would like to conclude basically with this kind of new results and picture which you get for objects which are actually not rotational invariant. So you don't take spheres. Let's say you take this kind of cigar-shaped spheroid. And so the question is, first question you might ask is, what is the actually preferred orientation of the objects to minimize their energy? So you have these two guys, and you're asking, is this an energy minimum, this or this, to minimize the Casimir energy between them? Actually, what I'm showing here is the interaction amplitude as a function of the orientation angles, which is basically this one and this one. I don't consider the other angle, which I assume that they are in phase, the two objects. And then you clearly see energy minimum here, which corresponds actually to this configuration. So they want to do this, which is somehow at large separations what you would expect, because we know that dipoles, right, they want to do this. But if you move to closer separation, it's less clear, because then you need all the higher multiple moments to include. And so the question is, do you have a transition in the preferred orientation if you change the separation between the objects? And that we also studied here. So what we do is we take a surface and put basically not a cylinder, but say a cylinder of finite length or this kind of spheroid. Okay, so we just, it's basically similar to what I considered before, but now it's finite and I allow it to rotate by keeping the separation fixed. And shown here is the energy as a function of this angle theta, which is basically the angle between the symmetry axis and the normal to the surface, right? And then this is a result at very large separations d, and the energy is minimized if this is pi over 2, that's this configuration. And then if you move to short and shorter separation, there's a critical separation where it's basically independent of theta. And then at shorter separation, the energy minimum shifts to theta equals 0, so you have this configuration. And that's really an effect of all the higher multiples acting together that you get at short separation this.
That's for fixed center of mass? I mean distance?
No, the distance you have to change.
No, but you measure from center of mass to center of mass, or from closest point to closest point?
No, I'm measuring from the center of mass to the surface. That is what I call D.
You could also measure from the closest point.
Well, you can rescale the data and then you have this, right? It's just...
then it changes when you rotate.
That's true, yeah. Therefore, we measure from the center of mass to keep that invariant.
Right. The interaction is very strong.
Right. Okay. So, actually, if you come very close, you would expect that the object wants to put as much material close to the surface as possible. So you want to have this, but then why is it opposite at large separations? Right. Okay. And actually, this is something which has been computed for Neumann boundary conditions. For the electromagnetic field, it's even more complicated, because there are some symmetries which actually tell you that there is no orientation dependence at very large separations at all. But these are questions we just started to look at. And that's basically the current status of geometry dependence.
All these are
numerical. It's a combination of two things. So we use this scattering approach in terms of S matrices, and these you can compute analytically. And then it's basically, if you want to include very many multiples, you have to compute the determinant basically of that matrix numerically. But that's not a big issue. That it's straightforward numerics give the result. Okay, I think I stop at this point, and I think we will have more talks on various aspects of the things during the program, and you're of course welcome to.
Questions from the people in the other room?
do you have any non-equilibrium setting which you may discuss, like something with the current? So steady state, which would not be equilibrium.
So you want to have electric current in one of the surfaces? Well, that ruins probably everything, because then you have electromagnetic forces and it's no longer a fluctuation force, and they are usually much stronger.
Well, but you do have fluctuations on top of that. So can
well,
you
then it depends on, well, I mean, actually, as Adrian pointed out, charging effects are a big issue. So, I mean, even if you don't have the charges as are sitting there, they basically, at large separations, they dominate the whole thing, I mean, the interaction. So. But I mean, people have looked at kind of non-equilibrium fluctuations in the thermal context. I think David started to look at these situations where you have non-equilibrium systems, and then he asked how these fluctuation forces evolve in time and how they saturate if you give the system a certain dynamic.
In the introduction, you said these forces might be related to large-scale structure of the universe. What role do these forces play in the scale
of the universe?
At our scale, in a scale of visible matter.
Well, I mean, they are, of course. I mean, they are long-range in the sense that they obey power laws, but in practice, if you measure the forces between, say, metallic surfaces, you measure them up to like 10 microns. That's where you can go, even up to 100 microns now. There are new experiments where you can measure and see these forces. But of course, I mean, this on the atomic level, these forces are quite important, and also in biological systems, where these fundamental forces. I mean, they give a huge contribution to these adhesive forces between surfaces. They're quite important.
And then, of course, there's another force which is totally due to van der Waals forces, called the nuclear force. It holds protons and neutrons together, which are also
It's kind of
color fluctuation.
Yeah.
And actually, in the case of a strong force, you're also not too far from a critical point.
Mm-hmm.
You have almost close to the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So the force isn't long range, but longer than your bubble on the
That's true. I mean, here you talk basically about the electromagnetic field, but of course you have these effects for all various types of fields. I mean, it's just
but you also have. You need neutral orbit.
Yeah.
Which in the case of QCD, you have protons and neutrons are totally neutral.
Yeah.
Color wise.
Yeah.
And the nuclear force is a long force.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's all important. Thanks again. Yeah.